Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
And I'm really glad to be here, even gladder than usual today, to talk to my wonderful, wonderful, wonderful cutting-edge, pioneering audience, professionals and laypersons, people who have been injured, people who have stopped injuring other people. You're a great, great, great group. And today is the second in a series of four in a row, a December celebration of the work of Dr. Peter Götze from Denmark, spelled G-O-T-Z-S-C-H-E. Peter, the author of Deadly Medicines and Organized Crime, and now Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial, a physician who is an outstanding researcher, founder of the Corcoran Collaboration. In Denmark, he heads the Corcoran Nordic Center. This is a group that tries to put some ethics and science into medicine by reviewing articles for their quality and evaluating them. Peter may want to elaborate on that. And he also now, as I am and many other folks, a blogger on Mad in America. And today we're going to focus on something of incredible importance, which is medication-induced violence, suicide, and other severe abnormal reactions, including psychosis, mania, and the like. And Peter has been involved in two recent research projects that are extraordinarily important in this regard. And again, this is the second of four consecutive hours with Peter, who is, I think, just one of the great pioneers in our area now. Peter, are you there? You're there in Denmark?
Oh yeah, I'm listening to you, Peter.
Well, I'm almost done. I want to go back and tell the audience, some of whom already know about these things, that I've done a huge amount of medical legal work in the field of violence caused by psychiatric drugs. I've probably done more than anybody in the world. And there's just no doubt about it. I write about many of the cases in my book, Medication Madness, The Role of Psychiatric Drugs in Cases of Violence, Suicide, and Crime. As a medical expert in cases surrounding Eric Holmes, who was one of the two shooters at Columbine High School. Eric Harris, I'm sorry, who was one of the two shooters at Columbine High School. I got to look at his medical records, and he was treated for over a year with antidepressants, starting because he had some obsessive thoughts. And over that time, he gets crazier and more disturbed and writes more and more violent things. And he gets a large increase in his dose toward the end, toward when this violent, horrible assault takes place on Columbine High School. And after the two boys shoot themselves, and afterward an autopsy is done on Eric Harris, we get the results, and it turns out he has, quote, a therapeutic level of the antidepressant Luvox in his system. The media has lied repeatedly and doesn't respond when I send them the facts. We have the autopsy results. We have the report to the FDA. Eric Harris was on, quote, a therapeutic level of the antidepressant Luvox, which had been given to him in increasing amounts. The Aurora shooter was on Zoloft for a number of months leading up to the shooting. He then, about 20 days before the shooting, he came off the medication, but by then he was very, very psychotic. Unlike Eric Harris, he went to the doctor saying he was feeling violent, and the doctor makes the mistake of putting him on Zoloft. So again, we have, from cases where I've been involved, haven't testified in court, but I've been a consultant, looked at the medical records, some of the most horrendous acts of violence. The Aurora Theater was just a disaster, where he stood in front of the theater and just fired into the crowd. I can tell you firsthand that these drugs cause violence and murder. If you look at my website, Bregan.com, you'll see the case in Canada where a young man on Prozac stabbed his best friend to death with a single thrust, just was sitting talking with him and another friend, reached down, grabbed a knife and stabbed him to death. And I testified in Canada, and they brought their best Canadian expert in from the local area. And the judge agreed with me that the clinical course clearly showed him getting agitated and distressed, and that despite his on Prozac, despite his mother's warnings, the doctor gave the 16-year-old even more Prozac shortly before this horribly violent murder. So I've been really involved deeply in all of this, and I'm really glad to see Peter Gerza getting involved. And so let me turn the mic over to you, Peter. You could start just about anywhere here. You could talk about your recently published research, or any place you want to begin on this subject.
Yes, thank you. I think I will start with the FDA, and then go from there to our two recent research papers we published in October and November this year. The FDA is like the little boy who's negotiating with gangsters, which is not an unfair way of collaborating. The FDA does far too little to protect the public against dangerous drugs, and they let the big drug companies get away with far too much. And as I have shown in my previous book, these drug companies, they behave like organized crime. That's part of their way of doing business. And this was very clear in relation to the antidepressant drugs and violence and suicide. 10 years ago, the FDA was pressed to look into the data, which means they really didn't do that. They asked the drug companies to do it for them. But one of the things that came out of that was that in 2007, the FDA actually admitted, at least indirectly, that antidepressant drugs can cause suicide at all ages. So it's not only in children and adolescents. And very few doctors know about this. They constantly tell their patients that it's only if you're a child or a young person that these drugs can lead people to suicide. That's not true. And I will come back to that, why we were able to show it's not true. But first, I just want to tell you that in 2007, the FDA humbly proposed to the drug makers that they update their black box warnings. So please note this. The FDA didn't require to have them updated. They propose, they negotiate with the companies. And what they declared back then was that everyone treated with antidepressants for anything should be monitored closely for suicidality, unusual changes in behavior, especially during the first few months, but also at any time of dose changes, either increases or decreases. And Then they mentioned some symptoms: anxiety, agitation, panic attacks, insomnia, irritability, hostility, aggressiveness, impulsivity, akathisia, which is an extreme form of restlessness, hypomania, and mania. These symptoms have been reported in adults and in children treated with antidepressants. And then the FDA went on to say that families and caregivers of patients should be advised to look for the emergence of such symptoms on a day-to-day basis, since changes may be abrupt, which is very true and very sad. These dangerous side effects can come like lightning on a clear day when people don't expect them. Now, a drug regulator who is far too close to industry that advises people to watch out on a daily basis for these symptoms because they can indicate that something terrible is about to happen, either suicide or homicide. That is really showing that these drugs are dangerous. And of course, it's a fake fix to watch people on a day-to-day basis. There are so many stories where people on antidepressants told their loved ones that everything was fine, and then they killed themselves violently just 1 or 2 hours later. So this is characteristic of antidepressant-induced suicides and homicides, that they are much more violent than more normal types of suicide and homicides, which are not drug-induced. So when people kill themselves on antidepressants, they might, for example, hang themselves, shoot themselves, throw themselves in front of a train or a car. Whereas if more normal people who are not drugged, they become depressed and become suicidal, then typically they will take a handful of tablets that are near to them, no matter what kind of tablets they are. So it's often more like a cry for help. Whereas people on antidepressants, that's different. Many of these people really want to kill themselves, and therefore they use methods where they are quite certain that they will die. So this is very bad, and I hear everywhere, as I said, that these drugs are only dangerous for children and young people up to 24 hours of age. And whenever I have said something different, then the psychiatrists have not admitted this, and they have learned from the drug industry that it's never the pills that is the problem. It is the patient's disease. This is why. And therefore, they have told something that isn't true, that the reason people kill themselves on antidepressants is because when the drugs start working and they become better, then they also get energy, enough energy to kill themselves. And this is nonsense. It doesn't require any particular form of energy to go to the bathroom and take a bottle of pills and swallow all of them. That doesn't require energy. So it's absolutely foolish. I think it's something they have been taught by the drug industry. Now, we then decided that because it's always the patients who are blamed, not the pills, then we decided to look at healthy volunteers, which are typically students who want to earn money for their students, and then they take a pill and they measure how it gets absorbed and metabolized and excreted through the kidneys, typically. And sometimes they get another drug to see how they interact. So we collected all studies that had a placebo group where people didn't get a drug, but just something that looked like a drug, so that these studies were supposed to be double-blind, so that it is more reliable what these volunteers told their experimenters about. And 10 years ago, the FDA defined the number of precursor events to violence and suicide, which included things like violent nightmares, tremor, agitation, nervousness, and so on. So we use the same criteria because they can predispose to violence and suicide. And when we use the FDA-defined criteria, we saw that in totally healthy young adult volunteers, the number of events that can lead to suicide and violence was doubled. When we published this, there was a lot of fuss in the UK, for example, in newspapers over there. Leading psychiatrists who got money from the drug industry, so I would not call them neutral observers, immediately went after me and said absolutely foolish things like, if we really believe that a little nervousness or bad dreams would make people homicidal, then we should have a lot of murders or make them suicidal. We would have many more suicides, and that's absolutely foolish to think so. But wait a minute. We say that smoking is dangerous for people. It can give them a heart attack and they can die. Inactivity is dangerous for people. They are precursor events. They predispose to heart attacks and death. So what do? We tell people to exercise. We tell them to stop smoking. So what we did was exactly the same. We have some side effects that predispose to suicide and violence. What does that mean? It means we shouldn't use these drugs, since I have come to the conclusion that it's not likely they have a true effect on depression, but that's a longer story that I explain very carefully in my book. So this was the first study we did. Shall I go on with the next study, Peter?
Yeah, sure. But let me just get a little involved and comment on some of what you've said. The violence associated with suicide, as Dr. Peter Goetze is describing, is actually well documented. There's a study in Maryland of an autopsy coroner study, and people who suicide on antidepressants have increased rates of very violent kinds of things like jumping out of windows compared to folks who are not taking the antidepressants but suicide. In the recent case that I was involved in is the psychiatric expert that's on Bregan.com in Pennsylvania, where we got an $11.9 million verdict for a suicide associated with Paxil of a man who was in jail. He did something that none of the experts on the other side nor I had ever even heard of. It was such a violent thing to do to himself. He didn't have access to any weapons in the jail cell, and he took I think it was a towel, put it in strips, made a hardened torpedo out of it that was several inches long, and jammed it down his throat and swallowed it until he gagged so badly on it that he died. A horrible way to die. And it's like a Paxil kind of a death. The other thing, Peter, you may not know is that list of symptoms that you described that is in the label, which is generally referred to as activation or stimulation, and that is also in your article, Precursors to Suicidality, that list of activation or stimulation was I originally published that in a 2003 and 2004 article in the International Journal of Risk and Safety in Medicine. And for some reason, the executive director of the committee, the FDA outside expert committee for this issue of violence and suicide, when they were rewriting the label, gave that a copy of that article to every single member, I don't know, 25 or 30 people of the FDA Psychopharmacology Committee. And that list is right out of that article. It's one of the things I'm really proud of. And I also testified before the FDA that the issue at the time I testified and cited my article, that the issue was much more than just suicide and violence. It was this overall activation syndrome, which causes also mania and psychosis. It's very amphetamine and cocaine-like. And so I'm really glad to see you picking up on it in the article. And folks, the senior author of the article, so that you can find it, is, I'm not sure I can pronounce the name right, but it's Bielefeld, B-I-E-L-E-F-E-L-D-T. I think you could Google it, Andreas Bielefeld, Precursors to Suicidality and Violence. So I wanted to give a little background on that. Please continue with the second article, the one that's on duloxetine, or what we know as Cymbalta.
Yeah, I'm almost giggling, Peter, because I had no idea that you were behind these various symptoms. So, but you're behind a lot of things, which I'm very grateful for, and we all are. But let me go to the next article, because we had access to these very long study reports that the drug companies submit to the drug regulators to have their drugs approved. So when they do a clinical trial, they might write a report of more than 1,000 pages, but what they publish in a medical journal may be just 5 or 10 pages. So, and it's very selective what they publish. So it's very difficult for doctors to know what benefits and harms drugs have, because after we have started to dig very deeply into these long study reports at the European Drug Agency, we have discovered vast discrepancies between what drug companies publish and what they write in these internal reports. And the sad thing is that these reports are so long that nobody has ever gone into these reports in detail. Absolutely no one, apart from the people in the drug company that wrote the reports. People working at drug agencies don't have the time to read every single line in these long reports. They don't do it. So when we do it, we are the first in the world to do it, apart from those in the drug company that made the report. That's pretty scaring, isn't it? So we got hold of 4 trials that Eli Lilly had submitted, both in USA and Canada and Europe, in order to get duloxetine approved for treating stress urinary incontinence. When people leak a little urine in their pants. And Eli Lilly withdrew the application in the States and Canada, probably because they ran into too many problems. But they succeeded to get their drug approved in Europe. And what we found in these long reports was really disturbing. First of all, I seriously doubt that this drug has any true effect on urinary incontinence. The effect measured in these trials was so small so that it could easily just be wishful thinking, because this drug gives people side effects, and then the trials are not really blinded, and then both patients and doctors would tend to exaggerate whether they now leak a little less urine. So when you see a tiny difference that is not even likely to be clinically relevant for the women, it's typically women, and it actually was women in these trials, then you don't have any result, really. But indeed, you have a result on violence, because these precursor events for violence there were 4 to 5 times as many of them among women on drug than on placebo. And not only that, but the incidence of side effects that can lead to psychosis was doubled. Activation events were increased, and these are the events that can lead to akathisia, to extreme restlessness, and ultimately to suicide and homicide. They were also increased, actually so much that you only needed to treat 7 women in order to induce agitation in one of them. So in my view, these results are really, really shocking. And when you look at the published trials in urinary incontinence, you can't see anything. You need to get access to these reports at drug agencies. So we live in a world where this is not only psychiatric drugs, this is everything, where a lot of harms and even death are hidden for the public. This is something the drug industry does. And therefore, we should use drugs far less than what we do. And I'm not only talking about psychiatric drugs. I'm talking about all types of drugs. But to come back to depression, I believe we have now shown in these 2 reviews that these drugs are dangerous at all ages. And actually, I will finish, this was known for a very long time from animal experiments. For example, fluoxetine, Prozac, which is one of the worst drugs, Eli Lilly showed already in 1978, it's almost 40 years ago, that cats, I'm talking about cats, who had been friendly for years, they began to growl and hiss when they came on fluoxetine and became distinctly unfriendly. And after fluoxetine was stopped, the cats returned to their usual friendly behavior in a week or two. So this has been known for almost 40 years. And yet, listen what doctors tell you about that these drugs are not really dangerous. People like Peter Bragan and I, we are just exaggerating. So now it's up to you, Peter.
I've been doing that exaggerating for a long time. I wrote about those Lilly animal studies in 1994 when I was the medical expert for all the original combined, the single scientific expert for all the original combined Prozac suits. And that was one of the things I found with the animal experiments that were already telling them that that even in less than humans, we could make creatures angry and anxious on these drugs. You mentioned volunteer study that you did. Originally, the whole idea was to promote Prozac as they finally did, as your first-line treatment with less side effects than any other drug known to humanity. And so they started their studies on volunteers, and they got so many people agitated, just as you're describing with the duloxetine, but probably even worse. So they got so many people agitated that the person in charge of the study wrote that the drug could not eventually, even if approved, hadn't been approved, it was just early volunteer studies, couldn't be first line because it caused so much agitation and anxiety in people that it would that it could only be used after other drugs had failed. So they simply fired him, and then they went on with the PR line. And then when the agitation turned up in the controlled clinical trials that they were using for approval, a memo was sent around from the chief of research, an illegal memo, saying put patients on tranquilizers if they get agitated while taking Prozac in the clinical trials. And that was not something that was allowed by the FDA. So in effect, they were studying not Prozac, but Prozac plus benzodiazepines and other addictive sedatives. So then when it came time to present two studies to the FDA, which is all they had to do, is take their many studies and pick two of them and present them as proof of efficacy, the only two that they could find that were marginally, even marginally effective, were the patients taking the benzos and the other sedatives to calm down the agitation. So the FDA allowed them to do it. The FDA actually approved Prozac in combination with sedatives and tranquilizers without telling anybody. At the same time, and one more piece about this, because this agitation issue has never really been covered this much, I think, on the air before. While I was the chief scientist for all this, I got to interview FDA people. And I interviewed the young psychiatrist who was in charge of evaluating adverse effects of Prozac. And he told me, and I got memos from Freedom of Information as a part of the process, that he saw early on that the drug was producing amphetamine, methamphetamine-like reactions in many of the people, and that if you had a depressed person and you gave them an amphetamine-like agitation, all these things that Peter Goetze, Dr. Goetze, has been mentioning, if you give them insomnia, anxiety, emotional instability, even mania and psychosis, hostility, aggressivity, impulsivity, well, this is very amphetamine-like. If you give this to depressed people, it makes them extremely agitated. Agitated depression is so unendurable, it leads to suicide and violence. And he warned the FDA about this in internal memos and said we ought to put in the label, the official label for Prozac, the stimulant profile. He called it the activation profile. And that's where I began to pick up on all this information, was looking at these internal files at the FDA. Well, the FDA rejected that, kept all that information out, and it didn't go in then until beginning 2004, 2005, years later, after a lot of suffering. And, you know, Peter, just to end on a really bleak note, and it's had very little effect. The label is so explicit about the activation syndrome, it's had very little effect on the practice. Is that your experience?
Oh, yes. this is another very dark side that I thought that maybe we should talk about today, Peter, that some of the worst of a very bad group of drugs, some of in among psychiatric drugs, some drugs are definitely worse than others. And you and I have found that the very worst drugs are those that are sold the most. So this tells us a horrifying story about how marketing and corruption and fraudulent research can make doctors use the worst among a group of bad drugs. This is really incredible, and I can just give you some examples. I believe that Xanax, alprazolam, the benzodiazepine, was the most sold benzodiazepine in the United States for a while, although it's extremely bad in terms of creating violence and even murder in some people. And then you told me that quetiapine, one of the antipsychotic drugs, which is also an unusually bad drug, is the most sold Seroquel. One. Or mm-hmm. Seroquel was the most sold one, or is the most sold one in USA. And then in our country, we have Cypraxa from Eli Lilly, olanzapine, which is also... Well, pardon?
It's an awful drug.
It's an absolutely horrible drug that seems to be worse than most other drugs in terms of putting on weight and make people diabetic. And this is the most sold antipsychotic drug in Denmark. And then we have paroxetine, one of the antidepressant drugs. I think it's called Paxil in the States.
Yep.
Is that correct? Pardon?
Yes. Yes, Paxil in the U.S.
Yes. I'm told that this is the most sold antidepressant drug in Australia. This is unbelievable.
And at times it's been the same way in U.S., probably not right now, maybe, but it's also been top seller here. It's deadly.
But this is unbelievable because it's very deadly. This drug has a very short half-life, so even if you just forget to take your pills with you at work and you miss one single dose, you can start sometimes to feel unpleasant abstinence symptoms that can predispose you for suicide and homicide. And if you forget to take the bottle with you for a whole weekend where you're going boating or something, it can end in a disaster. And then, of course, we have fluoxetine, Prozac, that was also the number one sold antidepressant for many, many years all over the world. And when that drug came on the market, it quickly became America's most complained about drug. The FDA received so many adverse event reports that this was far more than for any other drug. And there were hundreds of suicides and horrendous crimes, including homicides, hostility, psychosis, everything you can be afraid of. And sure, it doesn't really matter. How is it possible that doctors can continue to use some of the worst drugs ever invented? Can you explain this, Peter?
It's really interesting, and it's amazing that you've raised the issue. I've thought about this forever, and I don't have a great explanation. You know, in some ways, I think of it as a phenomenon you see in domestic abuse, that as soon as you start to call the person on it and say, hey, are you an abuser, you risk that person just abusing even more. Or when the person who's being abused stands up, they get abused even more. I see these drug companies as abusers, and when they sense that they're injuring people and they may get in trouble, they just ramp up and overwhelm. And that is definitely what they did. I had the inside track on what was going on with Prozac, and every time there were more indications that Prozac was causing suicide, violence, mania, psychosis, things which now those are really in the label and in the medication guide, they would have more secret meetings. They'd talk to the FDA. They'd do more to suppress publications. And now why people would be taking the worst of the drugs is a bit of a puzzle, but it may be because, as you pointed out, like Paxil's very short acting. So it gives you this huge, enormous impact in the beginning. Xanax, the other drug you mentioned, short acting, gives you this huge impact, and then you go into withdrawal. So let's say you take a Xanax and all of a sudden your anxiety is relieved for a little bit. Then it gets worse because you go into withdrawal in between the doses from Xanax on the same day. Take a dose at 8 a.m., you could be in withdrawal at noon. And so you think, my, I really need this drug. Then you get more and more anxious because the drug is so toxic and you think you need it more and more. And I think that may be the phenomena also with Paxil. So maybe when you first take it, you get a little high. It gives you a little overstimulation, these things we're talking about. Maybe that feels a little good. Or maybe it gives you the numbing and that feels a little good because it's got a powerful initial impact. Then you go into withdrawal and you think, well, I need this drug. And then you don't realize you're getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And finally, you know, you're in what I've written about, you use medication spellbinding. You have no idea what's happening to you. So maybe, Peter, today on this radio show, in response to your question, maybe for the first time I've most clearly unraveled why these most potent, short-acting drugs that have the worst side effects, including numbing, and including euphoria sometimes, will give that first impact, which gives some kind of relief, and then the person needs it more and more and more. I mean,
Yes.
It's not so dissimilar with alcohol and cigarettes, two other very short-acting drugs, and how people yes. get some sort of an impact. Then it gets worse. Then they need more.
Yes. But what I still cannot understand is that we have so many different antidepressant drugs. We have so many different antipsychotic drugs and so many different benzodiazepines. We have an enormous amount of benzodiazepines. And the companies are pretty similar. The way they behave is not much different from one company to another. And therefore you might wonder, how is it possible when there are so many drugs and all companies, they bribe people, they corrupt doctors, and they cheat in their research and all the rest of it. They do that, all of them. So how come that actually some of the very worst drugs that we can find, that they are the ones that became number one sold drugs? I just don't get it. It's so surrealistic to me.
I get it. I get what you're saying. Zyprexa is another example. When Zyprexa came out, it was supposed to be, you know, less harmful, and yet it had the zombie-like impact, the very destructive suppression, what I call deactivation of the human brain, turned people into yes. zombies like Haldol, on the same level as Haldol. Yeah. Plus, it was causing, as you mentioned, diabetes, pancreatitis, obesity, heart attack. Another Eli, by the way, Eli Lilly, doesn't it have the corkers? It's got duloxetine, it's got Prozac, it's got Zyprexa. But again, I think it has something to do with the potency. There's something about the potency maybe that appeals to the doctors too. I mean, you really impact your patient when you give those drugs. You see something happen.
For sure,
unfortunately,
yes.
You often see them get worse, and then you can claim, yes. well, they really need more drugs because they're getting worse, which is really a bizarre thing that's going on. This is not easy to answer, Peter. Ginger and I look at each other often, and we say, how do we explain this level of evil? How do you explain? And I'm so glad that you're coming out and using language, comparing the drug companies to the mafia and to criminal syndicates, because that is, in my experience, in the areas I've examined, exactly how they operate. And I'm not even going to get into the kind of threats that I routinely have to deal with from this pharmaceutical empire and have dealt with in the past. But I do. I shake my head over this. We've got something going on right now, you know, with Tom Moore's. We should mention Thomas Moore and his study. People can Google Thomas Moore, FDA violence. You know, he looked at all the drugs and approved by the FDA, where they're collecting data on them, and looked for serious kinds of violent threats and episodes, only serious things. And he found that 85% of the drugs had hardly any of those reports, and that some of them had zero or one or two. But that if you looked at the number of reports and you factored in the number of prescriptions so that that didn't distort it, that the psychiatric drugs were among the worst. And interestingly enough, the smoke cessation drug, I always block on its name.
Varenicline is the generic name, I think.
I'm blocking on its common name here in the U.S., but it's the major smoke cessation drug, that it had the highest association with violence. So it shows it's not just so-called mental patients. And also some antibiotics are related to violence. So it's not just even psychiatric drugs given to psychiatric patients. Some psychoactive substances push people over the edge into suicide and violent acts. And now what they're doing at the FDA is it looks like they're going to remove the black box warnings about this from their encyclopedia, however you pronounce it, and take it off, despite Moore's incredible study showing the association statistical in this very good epidemiological study. The FDA is thinking about removing it, the black box warnings.
Yes.
I mean, it's just,
it's incredible.
It's evil. Yeah, it's evil.
It's incredible how our drug regulators behave and how they bend, is that the right word? They bend to pressure from the drug companies. They're under constant pressure. And therefore, when the pressure is always there, they sometimes give up and let the drug companies get what they want, which can also sometimes benefit themselves, because then they can go to the drug companies and sometimes get a highly paid job if they had behaved pleasantly when they were supposed to regulate the drug industry. That's a very well-known problem with our drug regulators. They come far too close to the industry they are supposed to regulate. Now, could I ask you a question? Have you heard in the United States about this terrible accident in the Alps in Europe, where a Belgian bus driver deliberately drove into the wall in a tunnel and killed a lot of Belgian children?
I have only heard about it. Tell us about it.
Well, it turned out it was very weird. Inside the tunnel, there were an extra lane, and it was very clear that this lane was going to end. And there were signs showing this very clearly, and you couldn't miss it. It was impossible. So this bus driver just continued in the same lane and killed himself and a lot of Belgian school children. And it turned out that he was on, I'm pretty sure he was on paroxetine, one of the worst drugs. And he was in the process of coming off the drug, or had perhaps just come off the drug too fast. So there is a lot of indication that this is another Paxil-induced homicide, a horrible homicide, just like when this German German wing pilot took a lot of people into death in the Alps in his airplane. He was also on an antidepressant drug, and of course, it's difficult to establish in individual cases whether this would have happened if they had not been on the antidepressant drug. But since we know how dangerous these drugs are, and since we also know that it's pretty typical that the way people kill themselves and others is extraordinarily violent, then it fits all too well with the knowledge we have. I mean, if a pilot wanted to commit suicide, why would a pilot take so many passengers with him and deliberately do that and lock the door so that his co-pilot couldn't come in? That's not how you usually commit suicide. You don't take 100 or 200 people with you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The smoking drug name in the U.S., folks, is Chantix. And it's such a widely used drug and is the probably the most crazy, one of the most crazy making drugs on the market. And there's just so much data around all of this, folks. And you'll find a lot that it's impossible to cover it all. You'll find a lot of it in Peter's books, and in particularly for the one we're talking about right now, you'll find it in Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial. And you'll find a lot of it covered in my own particular style. It's interesting. We're both really in-depth researchers. And we come up with a lot of similar and a lot of different stuff. But my book, Medication Madness, deals enormously with this. And those two books, Med Madness and Deadly Psychiatry, will just give you an enormous amount of information about how bad this situation is. You know, for Peter, for me, it was very hard to conclude that drugs cause violence. I actually wanted so much to believe that a drug could never make a person do anything they, quote, didn't want to do, because I'm such a believer in emphasizing human responsibility and freedom of will, free will and choice, volition. All these concepts have always been and still are very dear to me. They're very central to the American ethic, to the ethic of the founding of the country. And I actually wrote early in my career, before I did all my research, that I didn't think a drug could make anybody do anything they didn't want to do. And I just researched myself out of that position. Because when you look at the data, there's just no question at all. And you mentioned, again, going back to Xanax, Xanax has a label warning that it causes mania. Here you're taking a drug that's supposed to sedate you, and it can make you manic. What crazy making is going on out there? And you've emphasized, and I've emphasized, you take antidepressants, hopefully to relieve suicidal feelings, when there's no evidence to ever relieve suicidal feelings. I mean, think about it, folks. It's very easy to count suicidal feelings. It's even easier to count actual suicides. The endpoint's easy to study. There's no evidence that any psychiatric treatment, antidepressants or electroshock, no evidence that they reduce the suicide rate. None. And yet we have evidence for both ECT and much more so for many psychiatric drugs that they increase suicide. So no help for suicide, but increasing suicide. And we call it an antidepressant. It's such a and I gather, Peter, you're going through the same dizzying experience I've gone through for decades now of how can this be?
No, it's incredible. I went to a meeting yesterday where there were psychiatrists also, and one of them compared antipsychotics to antibiotics and tried to say that if the disease was very severe, then we also were willing to run some risks in using quite toxic drugs. And schizophrenia is a serious disease, he then said. And I thought, my goodness, this man is a psychiatrist. He's trying to tell people why it's a good idea to use antipsychotics for schizophrenia, although they are very toxic because schizophrenia is a serious thing. I mean, this is incredible when we know that people with schizophrenia have better outcomes if you don't use antipsychotics. If you have a serious infection with bacteria that will kill you, you will not have a better outcome if you don't take antibiotics. You will die. So to compare antipsychotics with antibiotics or antidepressants with antibiotics just tells you how absurd psychiatry has become.
You know, the antipsychotic situation, we've only got about 5 minutes or so left, but I think it's so important to bring this up. Got about 3 or 4 minutes left. Folks, the way antipsychotics are studied for FDA approval, they're not tested on people who come into hospitals with their first schizophrenic break, so-called schizophrenic break. That's not what happens. The drugs are never tested to see if they help people who are having an initial breakdown because they don't work. They make people very sick and make their outcomes worse. They never test them in that way. Think of that. So every single time a psychiatrist or anybody gives an antipsychotic drug to a 19-year-old or a 30-year-old who's starting to hallucinate. It's never been tested for that. How do they test them? They go and they take hapless, victimized, chronic mental patients or in hospitals who have been on antipsychotic drugs for years. Then they take the poor souls off, putting them into severe antipsychotic drug withdrawal, worsening of their tardive dyskinesia, worsening and more obvious manifestations of their tardive psychosis and their tardive dementia. In other words, they torture these people by taking them off their antipsychotic drugs. Then they leave some of these poor souls on placebo, so they get more and more dreadful withdrawal, and they put some of them back on an antipsychotic. I know I'm shouting. It's really distressing. So they put some of them back on for 6 or 8 weeks or whatever onto the antipsychotic they're testing. Any dopamine blocker will do it. So the dopamine blocker substitutes for the drugs they were taking, ends the withdrawal, or at least ameliorates the severe, horrific withdrawal, whereas the control group is going deeper into withdrawal, getting worse. Then they say, we've got a new antipsychotic drug, and the FDA approves it, and it's never been tested on people during the first 6 months of their psychosis for FDA approval. The whole thing's a sham. The millions of people around the world getting antipsychotic drugs for their first breakdowns are experiments that don't work well, and they literally have never been tested under the FDA for that kind of treatment. Yet that's what the FDA allows to go on. That's what the drug companies do. Wow, Peter. It's just so, it's such a sick world.
Peter, I must comment on this, because the trial design you just described is what is almost always used for antipsychotic drugs.
Yes.
And this is a lethal trial design. Bob Whittaker has gotten access to unpublished documents and write in one of his books that one out of every 165 patients that were put on placebo, they died. This is an incredibly high death rate, because these drug trials usually only last for a few weeks. So you kill one out of 165 that you put on placebo. I don't know what the cause of death is, but I would suspect that a good deal of these people kill themselves because they become desperate because of the abstinence symptoms.
Peter, we're ending an amazing hour together with Peter Goetsche, author of Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial. We have two more in a row now with Peter coming up. And if we stick to schedule in our discussion, which we may or may not, depending on current news, next week, folks, we're going to talk about something that hardly ever gets addressed, involuntary treatment, what Thomas Sasse called a crime against humanity. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Peter Goetsche.